Hello, my name is Tucker Johnson, and I am your host today as we experience NIMSY Live, where we talk about the latest and greatest in translation, localization, internationalization, culturalization, and all that fun stuff our global audience of international professionals needs to delight their customers. On this program, we invite guests who like to have fun and have some value to add for our audience of globalization professionals. I'm always eager to provide a platform to those with a good story or a good data set, and today's guest has both. So if you have any ideas of topics you would like covered on future episodes of NIMSY Live, or guests that we should put on this platform who have a good story to tell, let us know. You can send an email to live@nimsy.com or just reach out to me directly. Well, without further ado, I'm going to get into it today. Of course, make sure that you are subscribed to NIMSY Insights, whether you are following us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, X, any of those platforms, or coming to you live on all. Of course, all of these episodes are archived on our YouTube channel, where you can check those out at your leisure. We've got hours and hours of great content. If you're new to the industry or just want to stay up to date with all of the latest trends, it's a great place to start. So today we are going to be taking a practical look at large language model translation quality. Specifically, we're diving into the real world evaluation of Google's Gemma. I don't know, our guest is going to tell me how to pronounce it. Model using the MQM framework and human in the loop review process. What happens if you apply structured error typology to LLM output? Where does it perform well? Where does it fall short? That's what we're going to be talking about today. In today's episode, we're moving beyond that hype and we're looking at the actual data. Today, walking us through it, I'm joined by Alexander Morawski from Alkonost. Welcome, Alexander. You were involved in this Translate Gemma quality evaluation using Alkonost MQM tool, giving you firsthand view of the LLM generated translations and whether they hold up under structured review. Alexander, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you, sir.
Thank you, Chaka, for having me. Long time no see. Been a year since last time, almost.
Exactly. And well, I've been looking forward to this conversation because I want to kind of cut through the nitty gritty today. There's a lot of talk about large language models, what they do well, what they don't do well. And I feel that we're reaching that point where it's not just talk anymore. We're actually going to start seeing data, which is what you're going to talk about with us today. Before we get started, I just want to set the scene a little bit. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your company, and the study that we're talking about today.
So I run a company, I've been running it for almost 20 years, more than 20 years. This is a localization services provider. What we do is just translation localization of everything that goes global, like games, websites, e-commerce, educational things, mostly some technical stuff. Like we localize software, and that's not translation but localization mostly. And we are developing a lot inside the company, because in the DNA of our company is software development. I'm a former software development engineer in the past and in the future. In this in this age of vibe coding, I write the code every day. So that's my era.
So you've been coding since before vibe coding was even a term.
Absolutely. I remember times I coded using assembler. That's so much time ago, so long ago. And through all the 20 years, we've been developing something at Alkonost, and this engineering thing, LLMs, AIs, is very, very our topic. I would say that we're happy that from the business side of view, LLMs are disrupting industry very much. Now, I must admit that it really just diverts some clients from traditional language services providers like ours. But I'm happy that there are lots of opportunities, new opportunities coming through this agentic. I also already call it agentic localization, the new term. Like it comes after vibe coding into localization industry. Soon we'll be talking about agentic localization. everybody, every who has this knowledge, some technical knowledge, is building something around localization, inside localization, outside localization. So we will be very soon see how agents will order translations. I think not people will be ordering, but some vibe-coded code going to order some localization from people or from other agents. So this is coming. And that's just an interesting topic, but maybe different. And now what I was going to show, we've conducted an experiment around LLMs and automation and people. So AI and people, and we just asked them to work together to see what happens. This the case is about we're going to present today.
Well, and this is kind of the question. This is useful for anybody out there to the data we're going to review today. It's useful to anybody out there, but I find it's particularly useful to smaller and medium-sized LSPs. You mentioned something earlier that I caught. I want to drill down a little bit. You said, you know, all of the advancements in AI and large language models, it's certainly disrupting the business side of operations. And yeah. I don't think anyone's going to argue with that. I don't think that's a controversial statement. But what that leaves out is, what about the language side? Because you can kind of bifurcate this into two different conversations. You can talk about, like, okay, what is MT doing for the business side? Crazy stuff. I don't want to get into that right now. But what is it doing for the language side? And how do we measure language, but in terms of quality? And you've chosen in the study, I'm just going to pull it up here, chosen in the study to take a look at it with human evaluation using MQM framework. And that to me is super interesting, going beyond the business and saying, all right, well, what about quality, essentially? So you evaluate, walk me through the study. You evaluated Google's Translate. First of all, is it Gemma or Gemma?
Well, that's a good question. Right. Never thought about it. Never heard. I just read it as Gemma, but maybe it's Gemma. I don't know.
Here we are talking about the importance of quality and language, well, and we don't even know how to pronounce the word we're talking about. Real good examples we are. Jeez. But anyways, this is a model that can be fully, you know, downloaded and set up on a private server, and you ran some different translation models through it, or you ran some different content type through it. And for the content type, you chose scientific, for something from a more or less scientific study, correct?
Correct. And also in the beginning, I would just make a certain disclaimer about this case study. It's called as we assess the quality of Translate Gemma, but I would not call this it in this way, because what we this case study about the journey of making such kind of experiment of this kind of a case study. If we were going to assess the quality of the LLM, the quality of the translation itself, that would be some another approach, because we would take longer text, different domains, different kinds of text, and different languages, perhaps. What we've done here is a kind of quality assessment. It's in essence, it's yes, but I cannot say that we assess the quality of Translate Gemma. It's more like a journey, like an example of how it can be done, how we can run an LLM, state-of-the-art translation model on premises, how you can organize professional linguists to assess the quality using the well-known MQM framework. So it's more like a story. I would not call it the quality assessment, because it's too stories.
Well, the challenge with, the story is a good one. And here's the story that I took away after reviewing everything, is that deploying, testing, and fine-tuning LLMs is not something that smaller LSPs need to be afraid of? And by smaller, I mean you're not Lionbridge, you're not translations.com or
Yes.
TransPerfect or WeLocalize, right? And I believe that there's this, I believe the perceived barrier to entry is a lot higher than the actual barrier to entry. And I love it to see that this technology and the benefits thereof is getting more accessible over time, even as it's getting more complicated.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. This case study shows the way. So, if you have some engineering background, at least you know how to code a little bit, with the modern agentic tools, you definitely can set up a server. You can definitely run the model. You can select the hardware you want to run it. And with the agentic coding tools, you can actually make it work. It won't be very optimal way, very so, but you will get results. This goes with the translation models and also general purpose models, and also with metrics. If you want to run some bigger X Comet metric, Automate or Google Metric X, there is a way that you do it. Don't be afraid of doing things because you have a helping hand of agentic tools nowadays, and that resolves many things. So it's not impossible for just one engineer just to set up the model and translate through it. So any localization manager with a technical background could run Translate Gemma and just translate everything with it. This is the one of the best models for translations in the world. Our benchmarking on production projects shows that it's really good. So I would place it just somewhere near Gemini
Well,
for many languages.
I'm glad I have you here in person because I read through everything. Just a Reader's Digest version for everybody, and for our podcast listeners. I'm pulling the report up on screen. If you want a copy of the report, I put it into the chat of the LinkedIn live session so you can follow along at home if you're watching us here or if you're listening to the recording. But you chose seven different segments from an academic paper, and the academic paper was about multilingual speech recognition, just to be meta. You translated it in the using the LLM Google Gemma, and then you exported it and analyzed it with human reviewers, right?
Yes,
Under the MQM framework. So 45 different linguists spent a total of 34 different hours over 6 days to actually analyze the output. And to me, this is always the best form of review of machine translation is what did the actual humans say? Even better if it's a specific content type and if those humans are specialists in those in that specific content type. But you provide a lot of data here on median annotation time per linguist, meaning how long did it take them to find the errors, correct it, and everything, starting with Hmong, unsurprisingly, going down to Portuguese at the bottom. What I wanted to take a look at, though, is I'm just going to scroll down here.
Yeah, if
The
you allow me a little
please,
bit,
please walk me through it.
a little story before of why so how did we choose the languages? So Translate Gemma just it supports 54 languages if my memory serves me right. So officially, and what we selected just for fun, we took 10 languages that are officially supported and other 6 languages that are not officially supported. And if you translate with Gemma, it expects the input in a special format. And if you ask for languages for unsupported languages, then it gives you errors. But as a prompt engineer, you can do a little prompt injection to ask it to translate in the non-supported languages, and it's officially documented in their documentation. So
So
we
you
asked.
can trick the machine into translating into
Absolutely,
languages that it tells you. Okay, all right.
yes,
Brave
it's an
new world.
LLM. And you can trick it. You can trick it to any language. So we tricked it to translate into six languages that are not officially supported, and including Hmong, including Belarusian, and including some Arabic dialects.
You see
So
these in
it
the
was.
brown bars for those of you that are watching the screen. So Hmong, Belarusian, Arabic, Arabic.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. So we got we've experimented with different dialects of Arabic. We are running a project currently in production around Arabic dialects, and so we were curious about how it would be translating differently into different Arabic dialects. So we put that on test, and the trick worked, and we asked Gemma to translate, and it translated it. It's best, and we got the translation. And regarding how do we choose the text, it was absolutely I don't remember. It was some random thing. My assistant just came up with this difficult one. If we were assessing the quality for true, we would be selecting different. We'll be selecting like news, public domain, social, something very like lightweight content, because the for example WMT data set, they have only this kind of content, social, some general text, and usually the translation quality is assessed using just general domain text, not this kind of scientific paper. If I could return, if I could return in time back, I would select different text, because the text we selected, it's a really stress test
Yeah.
for any model, for even for people. If you start to translate it into your native language, I don't find the terms in my vocabulary that I use there. It's a scientific paper, so no Hmong, no Ukrainian or Russian will be having those terms. So it's tricky.
And that's something that we sometimes forget when we're evaluating the quality of machine translations. Like, how good is the MT? Well, how good are humans? Like, if it's a highly specialized source content, it's unrealistic to expect the quality to be better than humans in a lot of cases because the training material is not there. And but that explains, because you probably read my mind where my questions were going, because not a lot of languages passed this test. Like, if we Yes, this is kind of an exploratory test. It's a stress test to push the limits and everything. But if this were an actual test with pass fail, not a lot of languages, quote unquote, passed it. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Regarding the tests, the test pass, if you have strict threshold of 99%,
Right.
then no model passes, because even with the minor errors, like in German, there were a few minor errors, but the text was very short, and even minor errors on this volume is unacceptable. But we're talking not about minor errors here. There are lots of major ones, like mistranslations, mostly mistranslations, and even in some languages they were like not using just different terms, but some grammar things, because the sentences in this text are quite long. They are hard to translate for even for human. And here is the model. It made lots of mistakes, and we just wanted to see how many. And there was a kind of when I got those results, I saw. I thought that is kind of a disaster.
Well, right,
So,
and that's kind of what I
lots of
thought
years.
until I read it further, and I was like, oh, you set the pass bar at 99%, so you set a really high pass threshold on this. So to say that all of the languages, quote unquote, failed would be, I mean, sure, but if you lowered that fail threshold or that pass threshold just a little bit, I mean, I've typically seen pass thresholds at 95%, not 99%, or anywhere in between.
many of these would pass. I was misled a little bit with our production pass rate when we assess the quality for production things and when the human involved, when we assess humans. So this 99% is, you can change it in the system. You just make it 95 and right. Everything is fast. So
and this is what I try to explain so many times. I'm working with typically client side localization folks and who want to set up a quality framework or a quality program. And as part of that, you have to decide what is pass, what is fail. And a common question that I get is, well, what do other client side organizations have as their pass rate? It doesn't mean anything. I could tell you 95%, but what does that mean? Yeah. How are they weighting their error types, right? Because if you heavily weighting error types, then a lower pass fail rate is going to be the same as a higher pass fail rate if you're not weighting those error types as heavily. So it's really kind of, when you say 99% threshold, it's like, okay, what does that really mean? But I can tell for the sake of your study, you set the bar really high, right? Like this is
really high,
a stress test.
Absolutely. And also in the real world, when somebody translates and there is a reviewer, a reviews and says, well, that's here is a minor style, some style or preferential here, there is a rebuttal stage when the linguists, they argue and then they come out with some compromise with the solution, with some solution. And we didn't give that chance to translate gamma. So we just reported everything, every minor, every preferential, every single error they just spotted. I think the linguists, they just hate models. They somehow understood that was an AI translation. And so they mark every error because of they just don't like AI translations. I think they were biased. I think they were purely biased. They made...
Which is good. When you're stress testing it. You want it to be. You want the deck to be stacked against the machine.
So what I was talking about, what I was saying about it is, if we judge the quality in the production environment, so the majority of those errors will be rejected by the author, like preferential or like. So it's many of the miners. They minor errors, they will be they could be rejected if we gave this chance to Gemma, but we didn't give it. So it's
well, and this comes back to, I want to talk about this idea of multiple reviewers and stuff, because in my mind this is one of the strengths of traditional human led review, and it's also one of the weaknesses of traditional human read review, is that, you know, attention to detail and debating over should I use this term or this term, you know, these preferential changes that you're talking about, that can be very time consuming. So, I mean, from a business perspective, my brain says, how can I eliminate that step, right? From a linguist perspective, I say, no, that step is absolutely vital. Because that's, you know, that's where the magic happens. That's where we get those perfect translations that are going to surprise and delight our international customers, right? In reality, the devil's probably, or the reality is probably somewhere in the middle, right? But you, in this test, use three evaluators per language. And I just want to read this. Inter-annotator agreement. Why multiple annotators matter and what low agreement actually tells us. With three evaluators per language working independently, we measured how often they agree, and the answer is not very often. This isn't a flaw in our process. You know, like I was saying, like, oh, that's an inefficiency. My project manager brain says, oh, that's a flaw. It's an inefficiency. But your argument is it's a fundamental property of translation quality assessment. Different linguists notice different errors, weight them differently, and bring different expertise. That's exactly why a single annotator is never enough for reliable MQM data.
Yeah, that was one of our insights. So we thought that two linguists is enough to assess. But we made three linguists, and they don't agree with each other. Some of them agree. They agree on the number of the on the quality of the of segment. Okay, they agree on major errors. If it's a grammar, then everybody reports grammar. But when it's minor errors like style, some preferential things, word order, which is correct but might not be fluent, but for scientific article is fluency is not just that important, like in marketing text, for example. So and they start to report many many minor errors, and they don't agree with each other. And I think in real life they would fight with each other to just for their preferential variance. Anyway, if it's it's interesting that it depends on the language. I think it's somehow connected with the structure of the language. To take, for example, Japanese, the 0.4 is quite high agreement. It's moderate, so they are more or less agree. This is because the Japanese language is more like standardized regarding the word order, the structures of the language. So if the language has structure, they agree. But maybe Polish people they have another opinion. They agree. They disagree more.
Yeah.
And for Hmong language, we only had one translator. So if you scroll down, let's see what Hmong is. No Hmong, because
and not even on the list. Yeah.
Yeah. Just one linguist there was. So our observation was that three linguists is not enough actually to assess the quality.
Oh, Lord.
So the multidimensional thing. First, how they were trained. First, how they were preselected. Who are they? Who are the linguists? Then I would sample more, like 5 to 10 linguists, and to see how the core of them agree with each other. So the more data, the better. One of the objectives of our this case study was to see how much money does it cost to make the year annotation. And so if we knew that 1 euro costs $1, this gives us some information, and we just could plan budgets. And what the tool we were using has about it is it whenever a linguist marks an error, classifies it, the timestamp is written. So by just classifying 1,000 euros, we've got 1,000 timestamps. So we could be able to measure the time they spent on the annotation, and that was quite another interesting thing. So some of them spent like half an hour for the whole annotation, and some of them spent like around 2 hours.
Yeah.
It's a mystery for me why. So they're so different. So whenever you conduct such a kind of production MKM annotation, you would be limiting that time. We gave freedom.
Yeah.
But next time we'll just ask, you have only 20 minutes to assess the quality, mark as much as you can, but you have 20 minutes, and this saves money. Given the freedom, you see 15 minutes to just 1.5 hour, that's also quite interesting insight.
Yeah, well, I mean, from a business perspective, that makes a lot of sense. Like if this were a live project, I would absolutely limit the linguist time. I'd say, you budgeted for 1 hour, or I budgeted for 30 minutes, please spend 30 minutes on this. It's interesting, though, to see this data set where you did not limit their time, because it shows how much time they would actually use if there were no constraints. And yeah, absolutely interesting. So the Hmong linguist took 90 minutes, an hour and a half, going all the way down the list here, whereas the Portuguese linguist took an average of 15 minutes. to review it. There's a big delta there, and I'd want to understand why on this. And also, you brought it up that we're talking about putting a monetary value to, okay, how much does it actually cost to annotate this? I think the next step would that be, okay, and how long will it take me to get a return on investment? And, how efficiently are those annotations being used? And how effectively is the model being trained to, improve, to create, I don't want to say better output, but output that it's more aligned to the preferences of the reviewers.
Looking at these numbers of times, I can. We never asked translators why. I assume that with Hmong language, it's not supported. There were so many errors, so it took time to mark them. The same with Belarusian and Ukrainian. Japanese are very precise, and they found every error. So it just because of this accuracy, kind of mentality. I don't know what happens to Russian people. Maybe I don't know why they needed more than an hour. But I see that the medium is just 30 minutes, and I would say that this is the target time.
Well,
And also, it depends on the number of errors. So if we take German and French, there were not so many errors in the text. So they just it just took less time.
well, and this is good data because as a project manager, remember I said I would always cap the amount. I would never send it to the linguist and say, use as much time as you want. I say, I budgeted half an hour for this. Let me know if you need more time. We can talk about it. But I'd always cap it, right? Well, data like this allows me to kind of understand, like, all right, what is a reasonable cap? Because that's a struggle I always had as a project manager. Okay, I'm going to send this to a linguist for review. I need to cap it at half an hour. But I don't know if that's going to be enough time for them. I don't know if it's going to be too much time. Am I losing money? Am I stressing out the linguist? Having some baseline data like this kind of it's a good sanity check to understand, am I being unreasonable with my expectations towards the linguist? Because the linguist, as you mentioned, there's going to be a bias towards machine translation. They probably figured out it was machine translation, so did not go easy on
Absolutely.
it. Have you come across, whether during the study or outside of the study, what is your experience working with linguists on projects like this that are essentially like hybrids using technology, but still wanting to enforce human quality evaluation? Are linguists generally receptive to working on projects like this, or is it a struggle?
I think half a year ago, there might be some struggle, some resistance in linguists that were not willing to work with AI to proofread it, to just to edit. But now, more or less, this resistance is gone because everybody understands that this is not a new world coming. Already come here with AI. And what we have in production is when not the linguist editing the machine output, but it's called APE, automated post editing.
Okay.
When the machine, the LLM, it just suggests the how to fix the translations performed by linguists and performed by other AIs. So those agents now using LLMs, they just leave comments. Say we're using a crowding platform, for example, but it's possible in any platform now. When LLM, you just have your Gemini go and read the translations and leave their honest opinion, the AI's honest opinion on the quality of the translation, and suggest some corrections. And many times it really works well because LLMs are just very good at following glossaries. Absolutely. They know the translation memory better than linguists.
Yep.
And they spot very small, like some tags, some wrong, some very small things. Even this kind of a spelling, especially spelling, they are excellent at spotting very subtle things that are not might not be maybe overlooked by the linguist. And so now machines are editing the linguist's translation. So to this extent, it's just going to towards this. So it's a mix, agents and people, and we see less and less resistance from the translators towards AI. AI is just with us, and we just work together, helping each other. And AIs really help translators to sometimes explain things, terminology to understand, or get better wording, because sometimes you are stuck with a phrase you don't know how to render it, and you're stuck, and you now just press a button to generate some 5 or 10 variants of the translation and select from that, and that's very helpful.
Or use that as inspiration and write your own damn variation, right? Like, and this is the thing, it's like, when we're talking about using, because let's take the conversation back a little bit, because we're talking about, you know, how do LSPs leverage this at scale, 64 languages, different content types, how can clients leverage this and make sure that they're not getting bad quality? But let's take it back a little bit and talk about from the translator, the linguist perspective. And one thing that I've been talking, when I talk with translators, is I always ask them, are you using AI? And if not, why not, right? Because this isn't something, I think this idea from the translators, you said it was stronger 6 months ago, this idea that AI is bad, it's here to replace us, that's AI that is being imposed upon us. But I've also talked to some translators that are using it themselves to do the translations. Now, what I mean by that is not that they get a file from a client or an LSP and they use AI to translate it and send it back, but they have a window or a tab open next to their translation environment where they're saying, oh, I'm not really sure how to translate this. Can you give me some suggestion? And they're getting inspiration from it. And I don't think that is anything to be ashamed of. I don't think that like perverts the craft of translation any more than using a dictionary would 20 years ago. You know, translate, if you were translating, you had a dictionary open next to you. Now, if you're translating, you have ChatGPT open next to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I foresee, but and also some platforms, already has this implemented. The translators, editors, they do the suggestions, and from Google Translate, for example, or from ChatGPT, whatever model you want, you get the suggestions. 5 suggestions, 6 suggestions. You can click and get another suggestions and select what you like. And this is just a tool. I would say that there are in the world not only translators are translating. Marketing persons translating into the native languages, why not? They are sitting in crowding, they're not linguists, they're not translators, but they know that they what they want, and they get it not from their head, but from an LLM inside the translation platform, platform's editor. And that's like internal translation houses of bigger companies. They just have their linguist inside, and they are not linguists. They just they could be product managers, they could be project managers, whatever, or marketing specialists, just translating some documentation or something without any linguists. And AI, since they are not professional translators, AI just is a copilot, is a linguist copilot for them, and they are not super professional translators to just infer the translation from their heads, but they can definitely select from 3 or 4 variants the suitable translation. And this is how the AI changing the way of translations are done.
Well, it's like I don't have to be a PhD professional mathematician. Give me a calculator and I can do just, I can do amazing things with a calculator, even if I'm not a professional musician. So kind of the same concept on that. I saw a comment from Anne says, yes, co-translator AI is a great example of translators taking commands. It's just, yeah, one example. Very fun tools for us. So translators are out there. They're using AI. What you mentioned, I think, is an interesting phenomenon that we're seeing, not just in translators, but across industries with AI, in general. But this idea of you don't have to be a professional translator. You have marketing people that are using AI to get the benefits of the knowledge that typically a translator would have. And it's this concept of leveling up existing team members, whether they're project managers, translators, engineers, whatever, is you don't need to, and I hate kind of saying this, but you don't need to hire rock stars anymore. You don't need to hire the very best translator. You can hire the mid-range, cheaper translator and use AI. I've heard this comment or this sentiment floating around there. What do you say around that? I'm interested in your feedback.
Well, I think
Right? That's kind of how I feel about it.
Telkinost, we don't work with translators that are not satisfying certain level of our internal tests. There's a very so you'd better work with stars.
Okay. You heard it here,
Absolutely.
people.
So maybe someone could be satisfied by not very professional translators. I don't
I think it
so
depends. It depends too on what kind of niche you're serving, what kind of clients are you serving. Because I could foresee a situation. There are LSPs out there that they compete on price. And we provide cheap, quick translations. That's the niche that they serve. There are some clients that they don't care about quality. They just want cheap, fine, awesome. In those type of situations, I think it makes sense to not have to worry about, leverage AI to the extent possible.
We
But
had such kind of experiment. Back in time, we had a Nitro Translate system, which is just you can top up your balance, go and order the translator the translations. So sorry, my son has come here.
it's all right. Mine are at school,
Just
otherwise they'd be pulling my beard right now.
what we had in that system, it exists just now. We had two tiers of quality. Good. Excellent and good and excellent, and we gave choice for people to select between good and excellent quality of translation. We measured the quality of our translators, and but secretly they were all excellent translators translating in good and excellent quality. The good translation costed less, but everyone was buying excellent. It was more expensive. Nobody bought good. Some few people bought, but our statistics show that if it's translation, that it must be the best ever, the best. So I don't think that somebody who will be just selecting between good translator and bad translator plus LLM would select this bad translator plus LLM. I don't believe nobody would choose.
Yeah, I kind of equate it. In my mind, I've always equated it to like hiring a plumber. If I hire a plumber and they ask me, "Do you want me to fix the leak with super high quality, or do you want me to fix the leak just a little bit?" Well, no, I want you to fix the leak. Like, it doesn't matter. I want super high quality. I might not be thinking like high quality, But I want high quality, and that's what you're saying customers are expecting there. But I want to move the conversation on, just move it forward though, because there's a part in here in the study that I wanted to look at, which is the human versus human versus automatic metrics, right? And so you have an idea here is like, okay, how does the human MQM scoring compare to the automated metrics? And this is particularly interesting to me. I'm working on some projects right now where we're doing a similar evaluation, but I think it's interesting to everybody who's wondering, how do I evaluate the quality output of my machine translation? I don't want to be paying three human reviewers to review everything and annotate it. Is there an automated way? And yes, there are. There are multiple automated ways. And you did a comparison here of which one corresponded the closest to the human evaluation, right? So which automated metric was the most human-like? And I'll just read it here. Human versus automatic metrics. How does state-of-the-art automatic metrics compare to our linguist assessment? We ran two leading automatic MT evaluation metrics, Metric X from Google and Comet Kiwi from Unbabel, on the same translations in quality estimation mode without reference translations. Both are neural metrics used in WMT evaluation campaigns. We compared their language rankings against our human MQM scores to measure how well machines can approximate expert judgment. And here we have the best is Metric X going down the list, Comet Kiwi XL, Comet Kiwi Base, Metric X XL, Comet Kiwi XXL, and Metric X. Walk me through this just a little bit, or walk the audience, I should say, through this.
This is my favorite topic. We are just running lots of automated quality benchmarking of different MTs between different language pairs and different domains. Every production project starts with every client just comes and asks, "Well, I need to translate everything by AI." And what happens next is we sit down and just classify the categorize the content by its visibility, by its impact, and then by its volume, and then by domain and types of content. Like, for example, you have user-generated user reviews, you have support materials, you have website, you have marketing materials, you have your app or web UI strings, and those are different things. And to select the right model for right languages, we just do a lot of benchmarking. And so those metrics we use almost every day to measure everything. And that was a very fun part of evaluating. We took the biggest one. So those metrics are for finding, roughly saying, they are for finding errors in translations, and they measure the number of, roughly speaking, they measure the number and the severity of the errors found in translation. So they are trained to do this based on the data from WMT framework. Google studied it many years ago, and then this data set is growing. And they have lots of data, and they trained those LLM-based metrics on that data. And that data is a human annotation, like this MKM annotation. There are some not just MKM, but also direct assessment, also year span annotation. So they have data, and they train the metrics, and now the metrics are capable of spotting errors in text and to somehow measure it and to give you some number telling this is good or this is bad. And those metrics are available in different sizes. So the base model can be smaller, can be bigger, it can be super heavy. The bigger the base model, the more languages it supports, the more languages it knows. It just so many data on the internet, but you need hardware, lots of hardware to run it, to infer the values. So we just ran what we had, everything, and so according to the to those metrics, they pretty much agree with humans regarding that there are errors. There are errors, and metrics tell that yes, they are. But it's we must be careful with different side of this. If this metric says that there are no errors, it doesn't mean that there are no errors. So if it's 100% quality, you can go with your linguist and see that there might be errors, but they are not spotted. But if the metric shows that there are errors, then there are just 100% there are errors. They are told in this way. So it's a good benchmark to spot the bad quality of translation, but not the measure of high quality translation. You cannot rely on the 100% the metric gives you. It's it might be not so, but if it gives you 50%, that it's 100% that it's low quality of the segment or the document. So we ran what we had over the text and this is an anomaly with metric X served by Vertex AI. This is the
really
API of Google.
It's really
and,
bad.
We should I think that's there is some mistake there. I think this is just a glitch back. We should investigate, but maybe it's some misconfiguration or something else. But when served just ad hoc from Google, Google's API, maybe I don't know why, but it must be checked. But now, when served by Hugging Face inference endpoint, the same model gave us what we expected. This is the same metric X, but we will be investigating why it gave, because maybe it's in our code, but maybe I don't know. I don't know. This is another finding. So if you go to Vertex AI and ask Google Metric X, you will get this number, and this number is low. And why? And so something wrong with that. This should be investigated.
Yeah,
maybe
it's an outlier, right? So.
But, To sum up, quality metrics of this kind, reference free, they agree with humans. If there are errors, then metrics would say there are errors.
Yeah, and I like what you said about, I mean, the machines, essentially, I'm paraphrasing here, the machines are a lot better at finding errors than they are about rating a good translation. I need to figure out a better way to say that, right? But it's better at finding mistakes than finding awesomeness, whatever the opposite of a mistake is, right? Good translations. Yeah. But I mean, this brings into the debate the whole, like, what is a perfect translation, right? Is there such a thing as 100% quality? You bring three different reviewers to review the same thing, they're going to find three different things, as I'm sure you saw some examples of that when doing this.
I foresee and have an idea of another kind of metric, or the way the language model is taught to translate. So now with these metrics, the model, some machine the models, they are taught to find errors. So they are rewarded to find the errors. But maybe there is a future world when we encourage machine to translate better and just give them positive feedback, so that they not spot the errors but make the translation better.
Yes.
So it's not a metric, but I would imagine a data set of linguists taking poor translations and then by some reasoning making them better. And this is, I think this is a future golden data set, that data set that could be used to train better models in translation, because everybody can come up with bad translation, but how to make it better and why, with explanation, with reasoning, maybe somebody's building already this data set in the world. I don't know.
Maybe it'll be you, and 12 months from now, you'll be back on here explaining your new, right? Well, I'm watching the clock here. We're running out of time today, and I have a hard stop after this. Any closing thoughts? I put the link really quickly. I put the link for this study into the LinkedIn. But if anyone has any questions, make sure to hunt Alexander down. I'm sure he's here to answer them. But how can people find you? What should people do with this information?
So type Elkanost anywhere, and you get my LinkedIn, and please just add me on LinkedIn, and that's it. How to find me? I'm very open. One of the final thoughts. So this MT is not the official site of Elkanost. It's our laboratory. So Elkanost.com is the website.
I'm trying to promote you here. There we go.
Yeah, thank you very much. One final thought about this case study. So going to production without people is not yet there. So we are very excited sometimes about the quality of translation that AIs provide to us. So we see that brilliant examples of good translations, and suddenly 20% of the translations are not that good. So it's like almost brilliant everything, but in very unexpected place you find the mistranslation or something that should have been checked by the linguist. So I see the future of translation in this agentic world, when the translations are really performed by LLMs, but then checked with the real humans, quality checked, and sometimes retranslated. And if somebody is dreaming of 100% AI translation, maybe next year. But not today.
Well,
not today, and it depends on the language.
It depends on the language. It depends upon the content type. It depends upon the desire.
Yes, lots of, better build a pipeline with a human in the loop. They call it human in the loop. And I don't like the term because it's not human in the loop.
I've heard the term. I want to give credit to Marco Trombetti for this, but I've heard it's like human driving the bus or human at the wheel or something like that.
Human.
That's a
much better thing.
Yeah.
And with these cloud codes and codexes, I think it the wheel will be driven by code, by some agent. But this agent will be, of course, supervised by.
So it's like the bus is driven by code, but the driver.
All the logistics, the localization service providers are providing with localization manager, it will disappear. No sending files, no even just confirming deadlines, any kind of logistics that can be automated will be automated, but there will be just the creator and just the translator and some agents in the middle. Even platforms, I don't believe that there are lots of future in platforms.
All right, I'm clipping agents. It. I'm taking this as your, I'm clipping this, I'm quoting you on it. 5 years from now, we'll see if you're right or if completely something completely different. So Alexander, we are out of time today. I got to run to my next one. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. Guys, go check out the study over, just search for Elkanost. I put the study link into the chat over on LinkedIn, so you can link it directly. Ladies, gentlemen, chat, we are out of time for today. If you enjoyed this NIMSY Live experience, join us next time. In the following weeks, we got some coming up. I don't think they're scheduled yet, but stay tuned. Follow NIMSY's LinkedIn page so that you'll be the first to get notified when we schedule new live streams. I appreciate our guest today, Alexander. I appreciate my colleagues here at NIMSY Insights doing all the hard work so that I can have these interesting conversations. And finally, I appreciate you, the audience, joining us live today. All of the questions, comments, and criticisms that we receive in the comments. I look forward to next time. Cheers.